This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today with
Sophie. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning. Because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
Folks, every Tuesday at this time, we spend some time and set aside some time, I should say, to visit with NOLA Coalition partners, not-for-profits, business organizations out there making a difference in our community each and every day. And we've been the beneficiary of seeing and hearing from some incredible people doing incredible work day in and day out, making this the place that we call home, a safe place to live, work, and raise a family and be different, right? And improve on our quality of life in so many different ways. And today's no different. Beth Burvant joins us, Executive Director of Cool Cooperative. Beth, welcome to the show.
Newell, so thrilled to be here. Thanks for taking the time with us.
Absolutely, Beth. If you would, you have a very interesting organization. Y'all do some really neat things. If you would, give the listening audience a backdrop of the mission and the vision of Cool Cooperative.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So we have been around for almost 11 years. Our organization was founded during a really unfortunate time in a family's life. The Stollard family lost their son too early, and he was silenced. And one of his great interests was to be a filmmaker, and he loved film. So they decided a little over 10 years ago to put into action a memorial fund and organization that would support other young budding filmmakers. So what we do at the Cool Cooperative is we teach middle school and high school students all of the skills that it takes to become a filmmaker, but so much more than that. One of the things that makes us unique is that we dip down into middle school, and it's a really uncomfortable time of life for youngsters to kind of find their voice. And through the skills that we teach and the camaraderie and the collaboration, all of these young filmmakers will learn the skills, but then also learn a lot about themselves. We work year round, and we go into schools and teach skills. We sometimes are that video digital media teacher, either in an after-school program or during the school day. We do after-school programs for free, and if students are over 16, they actually can get paid to come and learn with us because it's workforce development. A lot of these kids then can transition right after graduation into the film industry. So we do a lot, and we are quite busy and so proud of what we do.
Beth, when we use the term film industry, when I was growing up, that had like one connotation, right? One meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I think it's safe to say it's a completely different paradigm, right? I mean, it's a whole different animal.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Talk to us about that.
Since I was coming up. Sure, absolutely. So when you talk to our students, usually when they come to us, they think they know what the film industry looks like, right? So you ask them, okay, you're interested in film. What do you want to do? And usually they say, I want to be an actor, a director, or an influencer. And that's what they come to us with. So certainly influencer, there was no language around that when you and I were coming up because it didn't exist. But there are pathways for income that some people generate, right, from social media and working on YouTube. When they get to us, they have very little knowledge about what it takes to be in the industry at large. So let's just say a film, for example. There are so many departments of how to make that content. We often say in the film industry, we're a manufacturing industry. We just manufacture things that people want to watch. But it's very similar in how you train people, that there are unions involved, and a good living wage all the way across, but they don't know what those things are. So if you are an organized person, let's say, you like to do kind of tell all your friends what to do and we're going to organize a thing, you're probably an assistant director. If you like gardening, there's a greens department. So there are all of these different ways that you could interface with this larger industry in very, very common pathways in accounting or medicine. And then we bring these students together and they learn all of these different departments, how to do these jobs. And then they put together these projects together. And I think, frankly, that's one of the things that I love the most is seeing these young minds develop and find collaborators and other people that maybe they would never have encountered and work together for a common goal. And it's really gratifying. We, in fact, just had a young man who started with us 2 years ago at 13. And he said, Miss Beth, I have this idea. I want to write a boxing movie. And so it took him a while in his development to get to the place where he had a script. But he finally got one. And this year we produced this 15-year-old's film with him. He was acting as the director. He was making all of the, you know, like he was calling all the shots. And his whole team was young people, and it's going to be great. I want to make sure that everyone in your listening audience knows that you can access this work and see some of our student projects. We're doing a film slam, and every year we showcase student filmmakers. This year it's going to be May 10th at the Son of a Saint facility at 2803 St. Philip. And I probably will say that three or four more times when you and I talk, because it's so important that these kids get their work viewed. And it's going to be free. We're going to have a lot of really great activations with other folks in the film industry where kids and adults can see the impact that this industry and the work that we do makes in their community.
I got to imagine that this is a very exciting time to be studying film, too, because of so many technological advances that are available to kids at a relatively low price, right? I mean, when you and I were coming up, everything that had anything to do with film was pretty damn expensive. I mean, you know,
absolutely.
It was out of the reach of everybody. This stuff that's available now, probably half of it is free. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, a lot of it can be. Sure, there are software systems, DaVinci Resolve and even iMovie that, you know, come with your phone. And people are making real, really amazing content with their phones. Steven Soderbergh, very famous Academy Award-winning director, had made several movies from his phone. So it is very accessible to a lot of people. I think what is not as accessible right now is storytelling and how to tell a story. I think our students, you know, whether or not it's, I'm not going to blame anybody for it. It's just that the way that they're telling stories is different than the way we would have seen stories earlier, you know, that faster edits, it's much more action intensive. When we were coming up, it was slower paced.
Yeah.
So,
but that's kind of a byproduct of the way that we receive instruction today too, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, for sure.
You know, I mean, when we were coming up, we were taught phonetically, you know, phonics. We wrote out phonetically. Then we worried about spelling, and you know, the whole process was different. We're communicating now in snippets of English. We don't really communicate in the English language. I'm not sure what they call it. I'm sure there's something. I'm sure there's a word out there for it, and I'm just don't know the nomenclature. But you know, we're in snippet world, in my view.
One of the things that we see, too, is a lot of kids and a lot of parents and adults, just period, we are ingesting so much from our phone that most of our life we're looking down and our head is leading, right? We're not looking up to the world and walking with intention looking straight ahead of us. We're all looking down. And what we do here is we put our phones to the side and we are working actively on to try to ensure that our students are working together in collaboration, making eye contact with each other, solving problems together. And that is a skill that is very desired as they move forward in life for an employer and dealing with challenges. I mean, we deal with challenges in the film industry every single day. You have your day planned to film outside and you've got all of these resources ready to go and suddenly it rains. Well, what are you going to do? You have to make new plans and you have to pick up and recalibrate. And our students do that in this work. And I don't know where else they do it in such a radical way, because the project still has to get done in a very finite period of time. And there are deadlines that have ramifications. And I don't know where that happens in the same way. But it happens with the cool cooperative for sure.
Well, and it compels communication, right? And it compels the utilization of a lot of technologies, whether it be a digital camera, digital video, film, this, that, or otherwise. But I think more importantly, you develop the skills of public speaking. And I think that is really undervalued in society today, is to get up and speak before a group of folks extemporaneously, not having to give it a lot of thought, just using critical thinking skills. And the whole film industry, and from what little I know of it, is there's a lot of critical thinking that goes on there, right? I mean, you don't...
Unquestionably.
You don't develop what these folks are developing and putting on film without critical thinking skills, right?
No question. And to your point, that's exactly what we do with our students. And we build that muscle and we flex that muscle. And even if they don't go and study film at an academic university, if they don't go into the film industry, none of that really matters to us so much, really. I mean, what matters to us is that we're developing really stronger minds and stronger community and confidence. And that is something that you just can't, you know, it's overwhelming sometimes to see these students come to us and they really are shy and quiet. And by the end, they are just making decisions that on a crew of 40 people and they're in charge. And it's really remarkable in their development. But of course, as they go out into the real world, an employer would love that person to have those skills and be able to be confident and shake a hand and make decisions and recalibrate. So
what do you hear from kids that have gone through the program? I'm sure they come back and visit you guys. And you know, once you know they apply a lot of these, I'll call them unintended skills that they develop. You know, they're not really even aware of it until they go someplace and it's tested for them, right? What do they say? Am I making sense that question?
Oh, you absolutely. I can reflect upon a couple students just this past year, and they've gone on, and I'm not going to mention the schools they've gone on to because it's really not relevant, but most of them will come back and they will visit, you know, after at Thanksgiving, right after their first semester, and they're like, "Miss Beth, you taught us all of that. Like, I'm sitting in my lecture, and I knew everything already about some of the basics," right? And so they have a leg up immediately. The other thing that we see, again, if they're not going on to an academic track and they come back and visit us and we stay in touch with our students, it is always pride that they lead with. I am so proud to have been a part of this work and this organization. And we had a great time doing this thing. And my name was in a credit on a film that is on IMDb, which is the Internet Movie Database, where all of us professionals list our credentials. And they have a credential on there. So it's pride more than anything.
Yeah. Hi, how many kids have gone through your program?
I would say in the last, now coming up on 11 years, we're probably over 1,000 students, depending on where we've engaged with them. And sometimes that engagement might just be a field trip here at Second Line Stages, where we're based, and we'll take them through activities. Sometimes these students are with us for 4 or 5 years that we're developing them as an artist. So, yeah, well over 1,000.
And what do you find like as the biggest barrier for you in getting kids involved in this program?
You know, it's funny. We don't have a lot of barriers, but you know, there's a lot of interest. We just don't have capacity at the size that we are to handle it all. If I had my way, this would be a, you know, over $1 million a year annual budget organization that we had real infrastructure. We do so much with so little. We're scrappy, but we get the work done. But I would say that's it. I would say some real powerful funds to reach more students. One of the things that we're doing now is we've developed a curriculum that can be subscribed to. And so we can get our work into every school that wants it in the state of Louisiana. So that's something that we're putting into practice right now, because we really just want more kids to have this education. This is one of those specialized curriculums that people don't have. A lot of times in schools in the state of Louisiana, they don't really even have a good theater curriculum. But this is a really good curriculum that can be used by anybody. So just getting out there more and hitting more students, you know.
You know, in theater curriculum, what a lot of people forget, too, is that it has a history, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, it has value for
mm-hmm.
the future.
Absolutely. And we do the same. There is a film history, and there are lessons to be learned from reflecting back on that history. It's not saying that storytelling now is the best it's ever been. You know, there are things that you and I see when we watch films that, in my opinion, can be quite lazy, you know, in the storytelling. But if you know the history of how to tell a story going back to the Greeks and the Golden Fleece and the hero story, where we start with our kids and we teach them all of that from the very beginning, that absolutely bears fruit to reflect back on how it all began.
If someone has interest in aligning with you guys or donating to this endeavor, where would they go?
Well, thank you for asking, Newell. Thecoolcooperative.org would be your first place to start. On that page, we have all of our upcoming events, like the Film Slam on May 10th at the Son of a Saint facility. We also have links to our Give NOLA page if they're interested in donating. We make it really easy to do. And my contact information is on that webpage as well. So I would love to hear from any of your listeners that want to get more involved. They have a student who's interested in coming to us after school. But yeah, thecoolcooperative.org would be the first place.
And that's Cool, COOL, folks.
That's right.
Beth Burvant, thank you so much for joining us. We truly appreciate you spending time with us today. And congratulations on this program and best of luck.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you and your time.
Thank you, ma'am. That's Beth Burvant, Executive Director, Cool Cooperative. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. You know, folks, this last weekend was the 15-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe on April 20th. Everyone was celebrating the Easter celebration, Easter weekend. A lot of folks probably missed it. And I was kind of curious of the state of the state. Where are we? What is still unresolved? What is still hanging and looming out there? And joining us is Professor Bob Thomas, Professor and Director of the Center for Environmental Communication at Loyola University. Bob, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
So when we look back 15 years later, what do we find at the present time? And I know that's kind of a broad question, but what are we hearing that's still kind of out there, is not resolved?
Yeah. Well, I think the main thing is that we understand a lot better the impacts of a catastrophe like this on our coast and in our deep water. You know, the big thing that bothered the scientific community when it happened was that something we already knew, but we had just kind of let it slide, and that was that we really didn't have a baseline amount of information for the Gulf of Mexico. You know, what was going on at 5,000 feet? What was going on at 2,000 feet? And what would a disaster do in that kind of situation? Because there are so many values for the citizens that come out of the Gulf of Mexico. So now we have a pretty good handle on that. You know, we had about a $500 million budget over 10 years to fund studies in the Gulf. So we have a much better grasp on what's going on out there now. But are there a lot of unanswered questions? Absolutely. And are there still a lot of concerns pending about the wildlife and associated issues in the Gulf? Absolutely. And so, you know, we know as ecologists that that sometimes it can take decades for impacts to really become realized. But on the other hand, I recall because it was a daily thing with us, we had tremendous fears about a major catastrophe that would cause the collapse of the ecosystem of the Gulf of Mexico. And fortunately, that itself did not happen. But there were lots and lots of things that did happen to individuals and to certain species, and we're still tracking those. We have a great scientific community here that's studying these things.
So, summing a lot of that up, I guess the Gulf of America is a lot more resilient than we mm-hmm. ever thought it was.
Yeah.
But it also has parts that the fragility is probably greater than we ever imagined. Fair assessment?
Well, absolutely fair assessment. Look, these gigantic ecosystems like this are very resilient. You know, they've got all sorts of mechanisms going on out there that alter any kind of event that takes it out of the norm. And so we've been concerned. You know, our first concerns were dolphins and whales and whale sharks and turtles and things like that. But you know, most people don't realize that area where that happened is one of the two main breeding grounds in the world of bluefin tuna. You know, a tuna fish the size of a Volkswagen. And, mm-hmm. and it happened right in the middle of their breeding period. So there were tremendous fears about what impact that would have. And then we worried, of course, you always worry about whales and dolphins and the like because people love them so much. But there were lots of animals that died. There have been a lot of studies that are looking at those carcasses and everything to try to figure out exactly what happened and what can be done in the future. We spent a tremendous amount of time with the oil companies about how to never have this kind of a disaster happen uncontrolled again, because they had things in place that were supposed to be in place that would where they would jump on this real fast if something like that happened. But it turned out that the mechanisms were not really in place. And so we suffered for a long time it always tickles me also, not to get out down a rabbit hole here, but we always talk about the spill. This was not a spill. You know, this was a blowout 5,000 feet down, and it was gushing out. We finally got cameras on it. We saw the enormous amount of oil, crude oil, that was coming out of the heart of the earth, and we never, never knew where it was going. And ultimately, it was over 200 million gallons of oil that came into the Gulf of Mexico at 5,000 feet. And so we could say, okay, I can understand that much oil. I can understand that depth, but I don't know how they go together. And I don't know where it's going to go, how it's going to impact the rest of the ecosystem. So we really have a much better understanding of that today. Nobody can blow the whistle and say it's all clear. It's not going to be over. We're going to be looking at it for a very long time because that's the way science works. It takes a long time to analyze these very complex ecosystem changes. But I think that we understand our marshes a lot better. There's a lot of work going down at LUMCON, that some really neat research is showing us some long-term type things on oil and marshes. We've had tremendous science activity in the Gulf looking at different issues, but also looking at ecosystem issues. So I think we're in as good a shape as we can be, but we just have to hope that never happens again.
Interestingly, we talked a lot in the aftermath of this event about the ecosystem, uncertainty with that. Not nearly as much as the impact on the human race. And that issue seems to have lingered, Bob, I would think, a little longer than some of the others. And I'm told is still revealing itself in really odd and strange ways. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I look, as a matter of fact, I almost have to apologize because I always lead when I talk about Macondo with the fact that 11 human beings died. And those families were altered forever, and as well as the whole BP community. I mean, you know, that you have to have a heartfelt thing there. That they didn't do something intentionally to hurt it, but it did happen, and now they're living with that for a very long time. Forget about the money; they have a lot of money, but there, it's a very human element, and anything in that Gulf of Mexico is tied directly to every human being that lives along this coast. And I think that's something else that we have to come to grips with, because, you know, I don't work out there, but I know, but I have people in my family, and I have businesses, and, you know, there's just a huge business web associated with the Gulf of Mexico. So it impacts us. And we all know people who are impacted by this. And we all know people who have extreme fears about the future of the fisheries, about the future of the quality, and coastal protection and things like that. So I think it's a huge human element.
The aftermath of this Macondo well event actually kind of changed or accelerated, I should say, not changed, but accelerated the way that we were going to deal with coastal erosion and a number of things, because it really did reveal peculiarities, shortcomings that we had, challenges that were had. Your thoughts about that?
Well, no, I totally agree. And of course, now we've spent billions of dollars in fines and payments from that event to strengthen our coast. And so that's a benefit that I guess we have to acknowledge. Well, I know we have to acknowledge it, but so many of us rely on all of the resources out there. And so now this has caused us to do things that we would not have done before, and also gave us the funding to do it. And so we've got this big CPR program that has been a world model for how to deal with coastal erosion and sea level rise and subsidence and all the things associated with it. All the studies that are being done now about how we deal with oil along the coast, because we're always going to have oil along the coast. You know, one of the things that was in the paper the other day that is a good thing to be reminded of is that because we have so much oil in this area, and because of the fact that it's always been seeping, I mean, it's just, it's part of our environment, we have this incredible flora of bacteria that immediately started breaking this stuff down. And that was a huge benefit. It was totally invisible to everybody. Scientists knew about it because they had been studying it for a long time, but nobody knew what a big help that was going to be. So it's such a, you know, there's a term that we use all the time now that's called a wicked problem. And, you know, a wicked problem is one that is so complex and involves so many stakeholders and involves so many, as I use the word complex, complexities, that it's almost impossible to solve. And so a lot of us have feared all along that this whole Macondo issue was going to be a wicked problem that we would just limp with and it would cause huge destruction. And I think we've had some luck, but we've also had a lot of very intelligent people working on this, not only the scientific community, but the engineering community, the oil community. Everybody has been working on this thing for 15 years, and we're much further along. We just hope that we've learned the lesson to be prepared, to all be Boy and Girl Scouts about it. Always be prepared.
Well, you probably interact with a number of folks in this industry. I get the sense with the folks that I interact with is that still to this day, There's a driving force relative to safety, redundancy, yes. Systems,
yes.
Systems maintenance, systems management. This heightened alertness to safety, I think, still continues today, and that's a healthy thing.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that has been revealed recently and a while back, but it's been talked about a lot because of the 15th anniversary, is all the steps that went wrong, all the things, a litany of maybe 15 things that went wrong that caused this to actually happen. But yes, I know a lot of people in the oil industry, and I have some in my family, and you know, they always tell me, they say, we're constantly trained for safety. We're constantly trained for safety. And they would say things like, if I make a mistake and I leave a valve half open, I'm fired. It's over. There's no debating, no discussion. And so, you know, people that don't know much about the oil industry, I guess they think that these kind of mistakes are just going to happen because of carelessness. But and there's always a culprit. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to make
But human intervention.
Yeah,
we're fallible.
Yeah. but hey, they are trained constantly in how to deal with these issues. And this one just got out of control. And we've had others that got out of control. So,
no doubt. Bob Thomas, it's so good to hear your voice again. Thank you so much for joining us. We truly appreciate it. Professor and Director, Center for Environmental Communication at the Loyola University. Have a great week.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Stay with us. So by now, everyone's aware that affirmative action is gone as a result of a Supreme Court ruling relative to admissions to higher ed, except at UCLA. UCLA students are protesting against a professor who opposed race-based college admissions, and they describe his position as racist repression. And they are going after professors that believe in the Supreme Court's ruling, and they want to make sure that they've got all the power and that they're going to make these people miserable. In fact, the UCLA Black Law Students Association and other student groups organized the protests. And they held signs that named the professor and mentioned diversity and discrimination. And the newspaper, the student newspaper, is going after these professors as well relative to this. And even some of the Asian students where a lot of these cases emanated from that were being discriminated against, namely at Harvard, they are now standing up and saying that they support race-based admissions, and they don't like this either. Crazy world. You can't ever make any sense. It's always a moving target. We have to be against or something and taking on what they see as the oligarchy, right? A couple of people controlling everything. And that's kind of their view of the world now, thanks to who? Bernie Sanders, AOC, and others. Most of the people they talk to don't even know what oligarchy means. But they're alive and well and are going strong. They know it has a negative connotation, and they're just going for it. And here it is, more of the same. Forget about meritocracy. We want to define differences and give preference on differences. We'll be right back. Folks, don't forget, in the next hour, we will be giving out the password for the Jazz Fest tickets, a pair of tickets to the second week of Jazz Fest. Don't miss your chance to win. All you have to do is listen at 9, noon, 3, and 6 for the Jazz Fest code word of the day to see the amazing artists like Pearl Jam, Luke Combs, Lenny Kravitz, Cage the Elephant, Santana, Patti LaBelle, Trombone Shorty, and more. Good luck and happy festing from Miller Lite, the official beer, Jazz Fest, and WWL. And after the top of the hour news break, we're going to visit with Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. Kyiv is on the clock to respond to Trump's plan to end Ukraine conflict. We'll talk about that, and we'll visit with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.